once we go into PowerPoint, you can't basically touch it. Okay, let me get out of that.
Now, what did you do just now?
Escape to get out of that. And I just need, I just want to, this here. Okay. And I can show you the stuff.
You want your sound turned off, Grant, right now?
Yeah, I think it is on.
No, I mean your sound. Oh, you turned it off.
I think it should be set. I'll just turn it on.
Okay, I'm going to turn it off here so you don't, they don't hear you sneezing or anything.
It's off here too.
Oh, it is. Oh, okay. I think it's this one. So sorry, that's what was confusing. I put this up for myself.
Now we're down to 13 minutes.
Is that a sick person?
We're having a test, yeah. It should be a map of South Africa, you know. So Brian's out of town this week. He left this week. He had a neat opportunity to play some golf. I know he's with some friends, some old friends. So I don't know when he gets back. He's gone for 5 days. So Grant Van Cleef is going to teach. And really excited, yeah. So I'll mess in order right before I do. Most of you know Grant. Grant's been in this community for about a year or so. He came from Albania, where he was a missionary for years, first through YWAM, through which he met his wife, through whom he had several children, and is planting churches there and also doing some business stuff there. I'm sure he'll tell you what he wants to tell you. But when I think about Grant, I think of a Renaissance man. That's what I think of him. Those of you that know him know that. He's a guy who loves mission. He loves business. He loves to think. He loves to feel. He loves to act. He loves people. He loves his family. And just so appreciative of you and your presence in this community. So excited to hear him teach. Let me open us in a word of prayer. Well, Lord, thank you for this morning. Thank you that your mercies are new every morning. And that whatever challenges we face today, your mercies are more than sufficient. And thanks for this opportunity to gather as men, to gather around your word. And thank you for Grant and all that you've done in his life. And just pray your blessing on him as he shares from his life and from your word. We just lift up this time to you, pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Is it working?
Yep.
Okay. All right, gentlemen. Good morning. I guess it's just about all of you I've met here Tuesday mornings over the years. Over the year. Brian asked me, it's an odd time to fill in. He just started the group and he's already missing week number two. And at first I think he was in a bind. He just said, hey, tell some stories, and you've got lots of stories to tell and they can learn more about you. But there's also something from last week's session which I decided I wanted to dig into a little bit more, so we're going to have some Bible content here too, and it will relate to our beloved Joshua. But I'm going to try and accomplish three things during this time, kind of 15 minutes, 15 minutes, and then 30 minutes Bible. I don't have any rugby stories, I'm sorry about that, but I do have a few things to tell about Albania, so you can learn a little bit more about me and my background, where I was in ministry before we got here, and then a little bit, he wanted me to introduce you to the new gig I've got, the ministry / business, something you're going to hear about, partly just to inform you as a congregation what that is, but also our congregation is going to get involved in it as an outreach, as part of this new broader thing that you've been hearing with Ryan as outreach pastor, and also something I just love to have you guys pray about. And that's also another reason I want to tell you about Albania, is because last, the end of May, I guess it was, I went on another trip there. And I just shared a couple of things as a prayer request, and you guys have really been faithful in asking how that trip went and how things are going there. So I wanted to keep you abreast. I want to, you know, in a sense of us being in this together as a congregation, as a group of guys that are here Tuesday morning. So I want to fill you in and also give you, honor you by saying I'd like you to continue to pray for me in this new thing as well. So let me dive into the Albania deal here. This is the country we were in. Albania, which is Southeast Europe. So you've got Italy over here. Italy is shaped kind of like a boot, so it's just across from the heel of the boot of Italy, above Greece, which we're seeing in the news these days with financial stuff. And kind of up here is the whole Eastern Europe, the Iron Curtain. So Albania was the nasty guy within the Iron Curtain, the North Korea today, Hermit Kingdom. Didn't let anybody in, anybody out. I just sort of stumbled upon the place on a short-term outreach and for 19 years. So you see at the right here that a minaret, which 70% Muslim in the country. There's a guy, Skender Bey, who's their national hero, who's also somewhat famous if you dig into Ottoman history and things like that. The Turkish Empire that slowly was creeping up on Europe, and they said he kind of got them lost in the Albanian mountains for 30 years, and that was enough for time for Europe to regroup. So up in here in Vienna, they were able to stop the Ottoman Empire from taking over Europe. So it's about the only thing people know about Albania is a little bit of him, and I'll later show you Mother Teresa was an Albanian. So the Belushi brothers were Albanians as well. Jim and John Belushi. I think the list stops there. People, 3 million people, and there's about 6 million Albanians in the broader Balkan area, like 3 million inside the country. Here's a picture of me in 1991. We're sort of wandering village to village. The whole towns come out, are hearing the message. You're sort of preaching in these places where absolutely Christ has never been preached. So it was quite a privilege. Place of extreme poverty, I mean, subsistence living on all sorts of levels. Worn out, weak infrastructure. We're out delivering aid shipments in villages as well. Food, clothing, this symbol on these bags says Zofia Doshefrin, which means God loves Albania. Just saying he hasn't forgotten about you. The world seems to have, your leaders forgot about you, but God hasn't forgotten. About a third of the population left Albania or just headed out in immigration one place or another, took over boats, got drug across to Italy, and moved across the mountains to Greece. It was a tough time. The early 90s, chaotic, kids wandering around with guns, even had kind of a civil war halfway through, things started to get better, and then most of the country got caught up in a giant pyramid scheme, so they lost a lot again, and things got violent. Meanwhile, you have the resurgence of Islam. We weren't the only faith that was suppressed during communism, Muslims were as well, and I would say they're taking it hook, line, and sinker, but it's coming back. But we had the privilege of bringing the gospel to them. Could be, Land Rovers out in the mountains, could someplace you could only get to by donkey. And here we're carrying Jesus film equipment and then putting up screens and showing Jesus film in the remotest of places. We're having Bible studies. Even this is a church here to the left, meets up under the shade in a tree. And, there's something almost biblical about this sort of pastoral settings and things like that. We have a big, giant Jesus March for Jesus where the new believers are all coming in the central square here to the right. And this, where this cross is, there used to be a statue of the dictator, Enver Hoxha. So it's sort of, there isn't a cross there permanently, but we're able to put it up and we're declaring Christ at that point. Here's these, people all excitedly gathering in this old Chinese truck and with these posters and banners and wandering around the city, singing songs and proclaiming it. It was a pretty wild time to be part of. People were baptized. I guess it's the candle. We were without electricity about half the time for the first few years. So these are all kind of like pictures of the idea of traditional ministry. We are out there evangelizing. We're helping them get up out of the physical problems they're in. We're giving them spiritual food. People are gathering, coming to the Lord. And now there's 150 churches. Probably 10 to 15,000 believers. Nothing big, that's just, one Southern California megachurch, but something. And along the way, while I was there, I felt a new challenge. It wasn't just to be part of that particular birthing of something, but trying to start to penetrate into parts of society where the message still wasn't naturally going. So I got involved in both outreach to politicians. Some of that was lobbying for the Christian movement on different things, but also ended up kind of being involved in their lives, and also involved in business, as was mentioned. And so I became sort of the missionary in a suit and tie. Here we're signing an agreement with the government. We've got press releases. You have that was on TV every other day, it seemed like. They were working with the National Archives. One of the oldest, probably the third oldest portion of scripture in the world is in Albania. We had Rabbi Zacharias in town, and we got to visit the archives, visiting the heads of the different religious movements, as the Archbishop of the Orthodox Church, the head of the Muslim movement, dignitaries, North Korean military attachés involved in the ambassador's world. Now, this isn't to brag, I'm just saying it was a wild experience. Big fish in a small pond, got to be really involved in influencing the state on all sorts of levels. This is the Prime Minister of Kosovo. native version. It's part of Yugoslavia, which broke off. We're involved there. This is a prayer breakfast gathering, like the national prayer breakfast they have in Washington. We had one in the Balkans, which brought together politicians from different countries around there. There's our beloved Mother Teresa. This is the Prime Minister of Albania. We have arts and culture programs and things like that, not just to help the kids, but also kind of the PR sense of, so, you know, things like that were on TV. Your nightly news often included highlights of Christian events and things like that. All of that, you know, it's one of those ministries that I was still involved in, still sewing into these guys' lives, and still went over there for another prayer breakfast at the end of May, as I told you, which frustrated me, got canceled because Albania was in an uproar. Major protests because of what they thought were voting irregularities. So, prayer breakfast got canceled. Didn't, though, get to have time with the new mayor of Tirana and the minister of agriculture and the minister of culture. That's sort of like your secretary of commerce or secretary of labor, these kind of positions. And then we also had an event where we've got, these are three, two former presidents and then a former Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who formed this thing called Albanians for Integrity. We've been trying to get these guys to not just sort of gather and think about things, but actually to, you know, sort of stand up and make a difference in their country with it, which is a whole other deal in a corrupt, messy country. And also when they could just, you know, they could come to our events because we bring U.S. senators over. It's another thing for them by themselves to stand up. And we translated a book by Stephen Carter, which some of you could have possibly read, called Integrity. Yale professor, really good book, and sort of as a promotion event for getting that out, we also had a public event as well. It was really good words from these guys. So there's at least a little bit of progress there in that political realm. Then the business realm was part of, there's me, this is my Albanian partner, our former partner, Mimi Kruja, an Albanian, and we started a real estate development company. This way of felt stirred to dig deeper into the Albanian culture through getting actively involved in this, not just talking about it or promoting it. So we had a company that put together single-family home communities outside of the city in some nice settings, mountain views, grass areas, halfway decent houses, trying to advertise a little bit elegant international living as a lifestyle. We also were involved in the promotion of a plan for a major landowner to set up a big marina south of Tirana that actually hasn't taken off yet. I've exited, but you know, we were really trying to be the head, not the tail in society. We became the market leader as developers there. And again, small world and poor product and everything else, but still we were the best out there. And because we really, really wanted to be in those that sphere. How business was done. We wanted to up the ante on the product, on the quality, and do it all without corruption, and also be able to get in the business sphere and influence on their price. So that's the past, the Albania deal. And we sort of moved from one boat to the next. There's walking around Balboa. My wife and I sort of walked out of Albania a year ago and landed in Orange County. I am from Orange County, but haven't lived here for 24 years. My wife has never lived here. And we've had a great year, actually. We've had a wonderful time getting used to our new surroundings. Our kids have done well in school. We absolutely love the church here, which I keep saying publicly every time we have chances for testimonies. We're trying to bloom where we're planted and see what God has in this section of the story. There's not going to go into the whole reason of why we came back. There were good reasons, bad reasons. I mean, hardships and also positive draw to something, but we did not come back knowing what we were going to do next. Our organization, Y-Round, you know, wasn't begging us to go to a particular thing. If anything, they wanted us to go in the other direction, to go deeper into the Muslim world. So we came with a clean slate where we had the chance to think and pray, and part of that was talking to a number of you and others in the congregation about what to do next, or what God might be doing, what's God doing here, how might we be praying into that, fitting into that. Then a few months ago, probably 5 months ago now, I bumped into an organization called Apartment Life. which I'll quickly go through as well, which is an interesting ministry and business together, which is, some people call me sort of a platypus from my experience. I was a business background, then went deep into vocational ministry, and then within that ministry sort of migrated towards managing the Christian movement, to interacting with a certain sphere of society, and then actually doing business. So where does that combination play out? There's a lot of you who are in business and also doing ministry. Some of you have come from a more ministry background and got into business as well. But I'm sort of 24 years late into the game here. What's God up to with that? Are we just supposed to survive here, or does God have something involved? We found out about this. We grew increasingly excited about it. So this, I'm just going to take you quickly through what this apartment life is. It's an opportunity to reach what's next door, local outreach, what's going on around us. Turns out that 54% of people in major metropolitan areas still live in apartments. I mean, still live. I just think of the Southern California sprawl, suburban, we get further spread out, this sort of wall on a single family home. That's not actually the case. The majority of people live in apartments. Small majority, but still there's a lot of them. And then this is the key statistic, really, which guides why this needs to happen. If you live in a home, 40% of you would go to church. 4 out of 10 for homeowners go to church on a regular basis, while only 5% of apartment dwellers. You are 8 times more likely to go to church if you're a homeowner than if you're an apartment dweller. As I tell some of you this, you know, you can understand a bit of the difference. Young people may be transient, or maybe dual career, pushing hard to kind of save and don't have time. It's not until you get kids, you look at that moral language. So I understand there'd be a difference, but I didn't understand that the difference was that large. And that's not just demographic. There's something spiritual about that. I think whether that's spooky spiritual, you know, an attack against it, or it's simply that we've neglected it. Because apartment communities are not easy to get into. It's a closed door. It's a physical space that you can't get in there. Or if you get in there and you're, you know, harassing people, so to speak, with what you're into, you get kicked out. You have to earn credibility. You got to find a way to get in there. And it's not easy, and therefore we just haven't. So there's a spiritual opportunity, and there's a need. So this idea, love your neighbor as yourself, there's no greater commandment than this. Now this, giving you a hint at it, this idea is there's going to be to get people physically into apartment blocks where they can impact people. So we've got a need. Oh, look at that. It's not coming out at all. Are you going to have problems with all that? Something's not coming through there. The need is a spiritual need. 50% of people live in apartments. They are spiritually unreached. No, the key is to put on-site teams inside apartment blocks. But how do we get in there? How do we physically get involved in the lives of people there? This can be mixed with business opportunity. Apartment owners have a big problem with turnover. 2 out of 3 on average leave at the end of their term. So you have that almost every year. You've got 65% of people leaving. You've got to find new ones to come. If they stay longer, what happens? You save on expenses. You don't have turnover costs. You don't have to paint places, carpet them, things like that. You don't have empty apartments for a time. You don't have marketing costs. You don't have incentives you have to give. Big profit winner for apartment owners if they can get people to stay longer in their apartments. Turns out also that the number one driver of customer satisfaction, the number one reason why people might stay longer in their apartments, is whether or not they find the sense of community where they live. So you have 53% of people who live in an apartment. In the course of their lease, they never make a single friend. And if they can make a handful of friends, they're twice as likely to. That's a magic number. That's just, you know, simple something. It's a fact that the apartment industry is chasing all the time. What do we do about that? If I can get people to like where they live, they'll stay forever. Forever, I said that'll renew. But actually, if you renew a second time, your chances of renewing a third and fourth and fifth time go way up. So that's the magic thing. How to get people to feel comfortable where they are. So somebody can help them with community. They would get a great entree into the apartment. There's a sense that they would embrace anybody who would help them in that task. And meanwhile, as we've said, the church is looking for ways in which they can get involved. So these are those statistics at the beginning, and this is, thus, from those two things was birthed this ministry of apartment life. They've got the local looking to make community, sense of relationships, a place, you know, where people feel at home in the apartment world. And that happens through apartment life and placing teams in these apartment communities at the invitation of the apartment industry. The apartments give a free place to live in exchange for service, where you get to provide a certain set of deliverables for the department community itself. When I say that this sense of community is the holy grail, or the renewal is really the holy grail of apartment profitability, you know, it's not that they haven't thought about it. So if you look at advertisements in your Sunday Register or LA Times, it's Irvine community talking about how livable their places are, how many great parties they have, how much extra amenities they have, how the latest fitness center and things like that. And there's also financial incentives to get people to stay. We'll drop your rent. All of those things cost money. In fact, they cost a lot of money. So it's not just that we have a solution to it, but we have a solution that costs less, because all they're really doing is giving up an apartment that's mostly empty, and then a small fee, which helps cover the overhead. And then it's more than just your big New Year's Eve party. You know, you forget about that, or a beginning of school year, pool party or something. You know, it all kind of disappears. It's an ongoing set of social events, including the big one, but also smaller things that meet felt needs. Somebody who's in there, who's met you the day you moved into the apartment, who's become your friend from the very beginning, who's the one you see at the social events, becomes also a chaplain, kind of a chance to influence you going through tough times in your life. So there's a whole set of things which not only give us more content as Christians, but give them a better chance of that retention success. And it costs. What's fun about it is it costs. I don't know if I've got that in there somewhere, but if they raise their retention, 1% more people stay than would have 1% more renew their lease than would have before, it pays for itself. And on average, they're getting 5% boost. So it's a 500% return on your investment by bringing these teams in. I'm thinking, all I wanted was just to get in there and do ministry. And he's thinking it's profitable. And that's why the ministry's growing fast. Started just 10 years ago. It's in 13 cities, and we're just opening in Southern California for the first time. There's a great need, and I'll show you there. And this is just kind of briefly what we show the apartment industry, that it's creating community, it's resident retention done right. These are those things I described, that we do welcome interviews and events and care. A bunch of testimonies we don't need to get into, but you know, one company after another, 7 of the 10 largest apartment company managers in the nation use it. They're all saying 3% return, 4, 5, 6. Everybody's making plenty of money off of breaking this. So it's not too often that you've got a Christian ministry that not only doesn't cost us, but it actually is profitable for the business world. It's a marketing product that we're doing, and we do well because we're Christians, but they also do well also. So these are kind of details about different ways in which they earn. Or the average team, it costs like about $30,000 to put the program in a year. Probably less than that anyway, because you're getting, usually the apartment's empty anyway. But even if you paid full price, they pay $30,000 in and they get $130,000 in benefit out of it. I'm not going to go into that. It's just a story of a particular apartment community where all these really tremendous things happen. So the answer is that we're going to move into Southern California, everything from Ventura down to San Diego and out in the Inland Empire. And they have asked me to lead this initiative, which is a chance to radically transform lives in apartment communities by making Christ known. Making him known in a relevant way, in a cost-effective way, all that. There's been about 110,000 people who have been impacted spiritually through it so far, and the plan is to 1,000 boosted up to a million. And interestingly, here's, for example, Grace Church. Here's our address plugged in. All those blue dots are large apartment communities that could have an embedded Christian presence in there. Incarnational witness right in the center of community with his job description at the owner's request to be the ones responsible for human relationships, for making people feel at home. 5 mile
radius.
So this is just a list, one property after another, each 160. These are all that are 150 units or bigger. They're smaller ones, but we're starting with the bigger ones where the financial proposition is easier on the owners. Hopefully it'll shrink even more, but more and more and more altogether. 81 such apartments with 30,000 units, nearly 70,000 residents, just 5 miles in this church. And only 5% of those are probably going to a church on a regular basis. 19 out of 20 who you'd encounter if we get in there are not committed to another church. You know, here is Southern California, not including San Diego and out further than the Inland Empire, but tons of these possible apartments in certain clusters where there's more or less of them. Obviously, the Irvine area, especially with Irvine Company, in different parts here, Marina Del Rey, as you mentioned, downtown LA, Santa Clarita, Rancho Cucamonga, a few areas where it's particularly intense, but they're all over the place. And altogether, 1,983 such properties. 470,000 units and more than a million residents. Of big, you know, there's lots more apartment residents, but they're often 2, 4, 8, as we've talked about, smaller apartment. There's not really a value proposition where you give me 1 out of your 8 and I'll make the other 7 feel really cozy. But if you get 100 or more, it's a different thing. So that's my mission field now, is to try and find a couple hundred teams out in these, impacting these millions. Apartment Life is here, is launching October 10th officially. We're forming the team here. Another member of our congregation, Garrett DeBlau, a young guy, is going to be on my team. We've been talking with the leadership here. We're trying to place, we believe that we can place 3 teams into these apartment communities ahead. So as you hear about that in the future, we'd love to have you be praying for the right people among us to go, for the Lord to open up opportunities in the neighborhood. Yeah. It's a very good question, and I probably should have included that. You know, there's got 50% are already there, but the most maybe important thing is that there is a 1% increase approximately every year in the last years of apartment residents. And that translates to at least 1.5 million new apartment dwellers every year. So those are people not, you know, out of college and starting to find a home, but these are people who were formerly homeowners that are now apartment dwellers. And you know, the reality is a whole lot of these cases is that that's probably a permanent condition. And there's another reality. You know, Europe, 70% of people live in apartments. Always have, always will, because they think if you look at it neutrally, it's a better value proposition. You're more mobile for finding the right job. Your appreciation of property values isn't guaranteed. And, you know, so in some ways, it's not only there's more market for this, but there are more... you know, there's a strategicness to it. These are disappointed people who've left their home and they're stuck in an apartment. And what does that mean for them? You say, well, no, you could really make this home. You could make a whole lot of relationships and it could be pretty rich being here instead. So it's pretty important. And Doug?
You did push back, Brent, that they would say the property, that should be the property resident manager's job to do that. In effect, you have two giveaway apartments. Not part of the job description, they don't even think of that.
That's definitely one of the factors. In some cases, the apartment manager hasn't, the owner hasn't thought of it at all or doesn't have a strategy. Other cases, the property manager is doing that, but there's a number of pitfalls. One is they're almost always overwhelmed with what they've got to do. Two, they're really not good at the superhuman element. They're either concentrated on the leases or they're concentrated on leaky faucets and they don't want to do the put a social director on your property. And where people are doing it here part-time, after hours, so it's not actually a thing. And that's the other issue, is that those property managers are only there during the day, and they're 9 to 5. And most of the people are at work during the day, and they're home wanting this social interaction in the afternoon, evening. So that's when our work's being done. And so actually, it's there's some pushback, but usually you can overcome. And you know, part of the, somewhere along the way, this financial proposition is, part of this is staff retention. The value for the apartment owner is that you're more likely to keep your staff because your staff isn't burdened by having to do this stuff. It's not part of their job description they want to do. So, anyway, we appreciate your prayers for me as I step into this. We've got to convince apartment owners, four of them, to open the doors. The church response has been good. They are, there's two people. I mean, it has to be two singles or a couple, and they're each putting in 10 hours a week. So 80 hours a month is what we're offering. But many times it's more than that. It's, you know, ministry they want to do anyway. So they're at least promising to do those welcome interviews for everybody who comes in. Instead of a manager giving a call, we're actually knocking at the door, seeing how they're doing. If they found the local preschool, they know how to do their dry cleaning, they know everything's okay, and start to create them. They're doing at least three social events a month. They're doing renewal interviews just before people are supposed to renew, stop by again, and then they're available for X number of, they're trying to provide that caring side, that pastoral side. In many cases, the people who are doing it are people who are kind of like that anyway. They're running CPAs, they're kind of embracing doing block parties in their neighborhood anyway. So what you're saying is you can do that, but you can do it and actually be, you know, sort of patted on the back for it. You're not really doing it just for the financial incentive of the free apartment. It's probably overflowing anyway. And so they're doing another job. This is a second job they do kind of after hours. And get free rent out of it, which would be equivalent to about a quarter of their salary package. So, pray for the million apartment dwellers we're going to be trying to reach in the next years. Pray that apartment owners are receptive to it. Pray for us that we get started as a team in the next month. We're going to be training. We're going to be bonding as a team. We're training it out of the gate. Also, pray for us. We're looking for some office space and are hoping that there's some opportunity that somebody's got some overflow space that they're not using that we could use. Don't burden the budget too much with a place, just a simple place to get some work done, not presentation space. And I guess office furniture as well with that. So you keep those things in mind. Appreciate it.
What's your goal? What's your goal, staff?
Well, we formed the staff team. There's just four of us. Okay. So I'm the regional president, and then there's two kind of area directors, and then there's an operations. But then we will be having, we're hoping to have about 30 teams in place. So that's really 30 times 2, 60 part-time workers out there within the first year. Within the first year, and then it grows because you add more staff. And each staff member should be generating about 12 new teams a year. A team a month is the general growth pattern.
So, how that works is the financial incentive that you put out front, or the spiritual, or also the same.
Very good questions. We are generating those leads, and actually, if there's anyone else, it's the national office that has kind of leads with these big national companies and are getting us the inroad. And you have to deal with the owner, you have to deal with the property management company, you have to deal with the regional property manager over the thing, and then you've also got to convince the local property manager. Kind of starts from the top, the financial proposition. This is going to be good for you. Three out of four apartment owners that make room for it are not Christian, or at least are not doing it for the spiritual side. And in fact, they even are asking, are you sure you're not going to have a bigger back door than front door because you harass the people? No, we don't harass them. We just love on them. And it's fruitful. Embracing it. That would be a big word.
There is some backlash.
I think that they are. There are a number of people who are reluctant users of it. I would say reluctant. And the same thing if you go to Hope Presbyterian Hospital. It's the best hospital in the area. You don't ask the Presbyterian thing. And the fact that nursing was started by Christians and has always been staffed by Christians doesn't actually bother us. And it, the fact that we still punch above our weight in the nursing industry because we are just more caring. It's a caring profession. And we're going to be better at it than your average doc and more reliable and more whatever else. So and all these people are doing it for the equivalent of like $6-7 an hour. It's not... going to find that kind of staff doing as quality. You know, we're doing as better, as well or better than anybody could do it at a minimal cost. So you got to find people who are self-motivated for some other reason. And that reason is this. And we've got firewalls in place. They're not knocking on doors like Jehovah's Witnesses. They're not initiating spiritual conversations that might make people feel uncomfortable. They're responding to it. They're loving on people. And that's leading to other opportunities. But also, who are you to, you know, if they've got a bunch of young mothers in your complex, bring a MOPS, Mothers and Preschoolers program, into the clubhouse from the local church, you should only be happy. If I've got so-and-so runs a financial planning seminar at our church, and he's also going to go do it on, in the clubhouse, great for that. You know, so you can work your way around it. And so they say, okay, well, if you can make the money, you don't offend the people, and if they're really good stubborn, you say, you probably got a fiduciary duty to somebody else. Your gardeners, the lowest price, the best quality with people from a particular background, and you said no to them, and you know, use the more expensive one, you know, you have to answer questions to those who are actually your owner, you know, the owners of it.
What's the apartment owner? What's the apartment owner compensate cares?
So they're paying, they're doing three things. So they're giving the free apartment they're in, which is basically compensating the team that's there. They're promoting. Paying the bill for the social program. It's $1 a month a unit. So, and then they are paying $695 a month to CARES. So that's where our overhead's coming from. And we're actually getting something back from the CARES team that's in there too. They get a free apartment. They give a portion of it back to us because we want to have skin in the game. Ownership turns out to be quite important. It helps the budget too, but rather than charge $895 to the owner, we're charging them $695 and something from the CARES team. And with that, once we reach 60 units, it should be a self-sustaining ministry. We get some money at the beginning. We still need some. You can pray for that to reach that point of self-sustainability. But after that, it should go itself and pay for itself. So, no annual banquets, no.
60 units, maybe 60 apartment complexes?
Yeah, 60 apartment complexes with the CARES team in them.
Yeah. That's what this point is.
We are in 13 different states. Started in Texas, then it moved over southeast Atlanta and Florida and Carolinas, and then came over here in Denver, Phoenix, and now we're launching here, and we hope that we'll go up the West Coast out of here. They're not doing it because it's a religion. It just happens to be that religious people are the ones qualified to do the job. So, I mean, if another religious group gets their act together on that, you know, they'll compete with us. But for now, there's nobody in this space at all. And we're non-profit at the end of the day, too. We're self-sustaining, but we're not actually in this for so. If anybody else tries to, looks in the space, can I recruit staff? Can I pay them enough to do a good job? Can I keep them in there? Can I provide... reliably deliver this product. First of all, they can't, and if they can, it can cost a lot more than us. So. Unless a new religion comes up with a better package, and that's doubtful. It's more just convincing them that they need community and that it's okay if it's spiritual people that deliver community for them. If they do, they open the door for that. It seems they're making money, and it seems it's growing. So we're growing 20%. Interesting. Well, I love your questions. We got too much time into that, but maybe that's okay. It's because as I set up, this church will hopefully be part of that. Shall we jump into the Word a bit here? Not a lot of time, maybe we'll have to go a little bit quicker here, but last time, Brian opened up Joshua for us, so that's where we're going to be going in the weeks ahead here. And you might remember, so we talked about Joshua from Joshua 1, the secret to Joshua's success was that he would understand the power, the promise, and the power and the presence of God in all he did. And as I was, he also gave us a sheet. As we walked through Joshua 1, we also had an extra sheet that was Joshua as designated as Moses' successor and Joshua as Moses' aide or assistant along the way. And as I was reading through a couple of those things, I was sort of intrigued, thinking that maybe we could go back a little bit to understand something of who Joshua was, where that formation came from, how he evolved into this guy who's now taking over the leadership. And he's taking it over, being challenged to be strong and courageous. And we're going to read about some really, you know, exciting things he was part of, some troubling things too. But he took a mantle of leadership upon himself. He was appointed for it. But there were some experiences that he went through, a couple of them that I thought we could touch on quickly. They were actually both in here when it talks about Moses, he was Moses' aide. We're from Exodus 33 and Numbers 11. Were two references that I wanted to jump into for a sec here. So here, this is just a quick summary of where we, this is the other verse that Brian told us, that Moses had an aide. He had a guy who was his right-hand man named Joshua. Joshua was younger than him. Joshua was with him all the time, it seems, everywhere they went. Mentioned multiple times that he was referred to as Moses' aide, Joshua, the son of Nun. Even when Joshua takes this mantle and he gives his first speech to the people at the beginning of Joshua, he still refers to himself as Joshua, Moses' aide. He still has some kind of sense that I'm part of a lineage and I was working with this guy. That internship that he had, this multi-year thing, was part of his identity from the beginning. Here it says that Moses set out with Joshua, his aide, went up to the mountain of God. So this is when they received the law. Moses ultimately went up deep into the cloud and stayed 40 days before he came down. But first he went up with Joshua further than the rest, and they spent 6 days there waiting for what was going to come next. And then on the seventh day the call came to go up into the cloud, and at that point Joshua was sort of in between. But he was always going a little bit further than the others. Then in Exodus 33, we have a thing. So Moses has been up there, he's received the law, he's had this, you know, encounter with God. Then he's coming down. It seemed they had a regular something where they created the tent of meeting. You used to take a tent and pinch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Anyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke to Moses. So, physical tent. Something happening where a cloud is descending, saying, okay, God's here at this time. Their presence is there. And whenever they would see the pillar of cloud, they would all stand up and worship at the entrance of his own tent. So I guess they couldn't go up to the particular tent. They stayed back where they were, but they knew that something was going on spiritually up there. So they were joining in some way with this worship. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And Moses would return to the camp. And then there's an interesting little phrase here. But his young aide, Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. So a lot of times you're focusing on this, of the Moses and God experience and Moses' leadership at that point. But you have Joshua hanging around with him in that. You know, and to be honest, you know, so I have this question. Why did Joshua linger in the tent of meeting? One answer could simply be it was his job. Okay, I'm not going to be here. You guard the valuables or make sure nobody goes into the tent of meeting. Maybe because there was a rule that it was only for Moses. And he didn't want people hanging around inside there. You know, maybe it was just a job. But there's a sense to it that, or at least there's a possibility in the text, that he was also there just hanging out in the presence of God. And, you know, it reality might be a combination of both of those things. Maybe it was his job to be there, and while he was there, he also started to encounter God in a different way. And he lingered. He just wanted to stay there. Okay, this thing's over. Okay, the clouds lifted. Everybody else stops worshiping in their tent and goes back and fix the beans and rice. But Joshua said, no, actually, I'm okay here. He started to taste something. God, no, I'm just going to hang out here a little bit. You guys go ahead. And I think this is going to be important. When we talk about the power and the promise and the presence of God as Joshua's secret, there's something about him encountering God and being in the presence of God that he tasted before, and he tasted it in a way that wanted him to have more of it. And as we'll also pull it up at the end, in Exodus, I believe it's 27, Joshua's not just hanging out in the tent, he's out in battle. He's representing, he's also starting to lead the troops, that Moses' leadership. He's out doing physical things, doing the work, pushing forward in all these ways, but there was always something in him that was also, at the same time as he could be a man of action, he could also be a laborer in the presence of God. Not someone that could be challenged to do that 10-minute of quiet time each morning, but actually, I'm kind of looking forward to reading and also getting a chance to absorb, see what God's up to. Always a little bit more. Action together with the unction, someone referred to it as. So, that was the first one was that Exodus reference when there's an encounter with the presence of God. And there's an interesting also passage, which I just wanted to dig into a little bit from Numbers 11, which is Moses extremely frustrated because of this burden that he has of leading these people. And the people, if you read through Numbers chapter 11, and it continues, and 12, and 14, and 16, there's just one story after another of whiny people that he's responsible for leading. Short-sighted people, people with a memory that just, no memory, basically. It's just like they got Alzheimer's. They can't even remember what they learned yesterday. They're having trouble applying it, they're having trouble believing it, and Moses is responsible for them. If you ever think that leadership is a great thing to have, many of you have been leaders in business and things, and there's a good side. You can control certain things. You can be in charge, and there can be financial benefits. But there's also lots of sleepless nights. There's also extreme frustration with dealing with any staff. There's extreme frustration with meeting guidelines, expectations, all that. And Moses was obviously no exception, which is probably why Moses kind of whined from the very beginning. I don't really want this job. I've got I got this tongue. I can't really speak. What were those problems? We can talk about. At the end of the day, it was probably just looking for an excuse to not have to do what he was being called to do. Kind of reaches a crux here in Numbers 11 when Moses is talking to God and says, did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth? Why did you tell me to carry them in my arms? As a nurse carries an infant. As a nurse carries an infant, it's a good metaphor. They were like helpless little, these people were pathetic, basically. And I've got to just baby them all along, babysitting them step by step. I've got to carry them all the way to this land that you promised them on oath. Okay, we've got this destination, but I'm having to do all the hard work. Where can I get meat for all these people? They keep wailing to me, give us meat to eat. I cannot carry all these people by myself. The burden is too heavy for me. So, Moses lays it out before God. This is a job too big for me. There's too much to do, and I'm not sure how it's going to work out. So, I don't know if he was really suicidal or if he was just sort of a little manipulative with God. Well, if you're going to stick this assignment, fine, just take me. It's better to die than have to deal with this. But, which I would say is, could be manipulative, could be just, he was really depressed, but it was pretty serious. To some extent, he was not just playing with words, not just frustrated. He was really deep in depression on the subject. And he wanted a way out. And the way out was, he said, I'm not going to be able to. If I found favor in your own, do not let me face my own ruin. So God came up with a solution for him. And that solution, we'll read. read about here. So Moses went out and told the people what the Lord had said. He brought together 70 of the elders and had them stand around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke with him. And he took of the spirit that was on him, Moses. God took the spirit that was on Moses and put the spirit on the 70 elders. When the spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they didn't do so again. However, two men, whose names Eldad and Medad, who remained in the camp when they were listening among the elders, but did not go out to the tent. We'll get into that in a second. So, fairly practical solution. Let's spread the burden. Let's delegate. It's not the first time Moses had had delegation be a solution to his problems. You remember the story of his father-in-law, Jethro, that said, this isn't right. You're judging all these cases. You're becoming a bottleneck. You're getting worn out. You need to create a structure. Good management can be spiritual. That's not taken, setting aside the unction side, the God spirit side. It can actually be God's answer. Is that we need to delegate. There's also a sense, it wasn't, I think, just giving more people to be filled with godly leadership, managerial skills or something. There was also a sense of, I call it like a spiritual fraternity. These guys had tasted something of what he was tasting and had now understood why that needed to be first and foremost, why God was to be trusted, why God should lead us forward and we should put our trust, our faith in him. Same thing, some kind of fraternity, have some kind of bonding. If you all know the secret handshake, or say DTS graduates, that's everybody who's finished this YWAM, Youth with a Mission training school. They're all over the world. There's a million of us everywhere. But you meet them in the strangest of places, and you just bond because you know, oh, you went through that 24-week incubator thing called the DTS. There's a bonding if you've gone through something together. I think God was giving that to Moses as well. And I guess there's some sense of, as I was saying, that this is just an anointing. It was a supernatural something that happened as well. It was one more confirmation for them that God was still with them in general. But it was also, he was with a specific group of people who now had an anointing for leadership to help him with that. And they were also comrades, spiritual comrades for Moses in that. Came on 70 people, and then there were two other people, Eldad and Medad, who didn't get the memo, didn't show up at the spiritual anointing party. They were back at the camp, but all of a sudden the Spirit came on them too. The Spirit also rested on them, and they prophesied in the camp. So that this is really getting out of control. This is outside of church, like moving on into the marketplace. I don't know if they were raising their hands. Maybe they were, did some supernatural letters. Maybe they were, who knows what was actually happening. But the Spirit was spreading out. It was starting to get out of control. And then our beloved Joshua, man of great faith, who'd been Moses' aide since his youth, spoke up and said, Moses, my Lord, stop them. This is getting outside of what we're used to. This is not the program that the elders signed up for or charted at the beginning. This is Spirit getting a little bit out of control, and we need to hold back on that. Moses said, are you jealous for my sake? I wish that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit on them. Somehow Joshua was the one that wanted to hold back and say, let's keep this in control, let's keep a lid on this, let's keep a good solid program that we can chart a course forward on. And Moses actually is the one that is able to let go and be a little more free about it. Why do you think that's the case? Why was Moses able to? Moses was secure in his position with God. Why would that be? Where did that security come from?
His personal experience. He's stuck with what is that maybe he knows that he knows that God's going to direct him and guide him. He doesn't have to worry about himself at all.
He doesn't have a self-interest. He's not concerned about keeping power. He's tasted something of God. Anyone else have any other thoughts?
Others who have Moses control, Joshua, and Moses. I don't know.
there's something specific about, you know, maybe he wasn't trying to control it, but he was worried about his boss's role, his boss's job description, the uniqueness of who he was. But somehow Moses said, oh, you know what? Don't worry about me. The more the merrier in terms of God's ministry happening. Which reminds me of a passage from John 3. We shouldn't go through all this, but John the Baptist, it's just a fascinating parallel there. The same thing. When John the Baptist was getting popular and had many people thinking he was a hero and he had this or that, and John the Baptist's immediate answer when anybody said, yeah, but there's something threatening to your ministry or your position, or your, he was able to say, a man can only receive what is given him from heaven. You can testify, I've never said that I'm the Christ. I'm just a bridegroom. I'm a best man, basically helping the bridegroom get married. So I'm full of joy when I hear the bridegroom's voice. The joy is not mine, and it's now complete. He must become greater, and I must become less. And then again, I thought 34 says, for the one whom God sent speaks the words of God, and God gives the Spirit without limit. So God is interested in empowering more people. He is interested in that happening from us and passing on to the next crowd, and or never have our own attitude on keeping something for ourselves, our particular little deal here. It's worth dwelling on that John the Baptist, like Moses, had reached a point in their leadership and the clarity of their call, they were able to let go on a moment's notice, really spontaneously, when called to something like that, which is really not easy at all. There's some deep level spiritual maturity and experience that allows someone to say, I can only receive what God's given me, and I hold it lightly. I take responsibility. I hold it seriously. I want to be a part of it, but I also say, it's not mine, it's God's. You make room for the next stage. So all sorts of questions. This is the part I think we won't get into, but again, he's saying, are you jealous for my sake? I wish there could be more of them. I'm not worried about even some spirit getting, somebody coming up with some new idea that might be threatening to the status quo, that might be sort of, possibly not even for the right motives. This is a clear thing. God put his Spirit on a couple of people, but there can, in a given congregational life, it's not unheard of for a couple of people to come up with an idea and call it Spirit-led. God spoke, and I should be doing this. What's our response in that? The Bible doesn't encourage rebellion. There's plenty of stories, including the chapters afterwards in Numbers, where spiritual rebellion is pretty dangerous. Even those verses there, Jeremiah, don't seek great things for yourself. But at the same time, there's a sense that, what did Joseph's brothers think of him when he told them about the dream he had, the dream that he was to be in leadership, and in fact, he was going to save them and all this stuff. And, nobody was responsive to that, but at the end of the day, it was Joshua. Joshua did actually hear that one correctly. Joseph did, sorry. Jeremiah receiving a call to ministry even as a young kid. He was supposed to speak up about it and not hesitate. Things like the prayer of Jabez, which might like or not like what's said in that book, but the text is still there. Lord, expand my territory, enlarge my territory, bless me, keep me from harm. Wanting more of ministry, expand my opportunities. In that sense of spiritual interest, can that possibly be of God? God is calling people, and we should be embracing it and saying yes, the more the merrier. Philippians 1:18 is a key text we all need to keep in mind as well, that Paul's had some people that had some ideas, are promoting themselves, and he's like, hey, I'm not sure if that's the right deal. But in the end of the day, that's not for me to worry about. What matters for me is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice. So, I kind of combine all these things together, and I say, are we going to be people that are expecting the Spirit to permeate, put tentacles out in the lives of people we believe that he can reach through, stir up people we wouldn't expect to be stirred up, to expect that he might even create ministry opportunities through people in unexpected places. We people who are going to embrace that possibility. say that we, as a congregation as a whole, but I have to say that as, you know, part of this is as maybe seasoned people. That's right. You know, the most unexpected places, and we should be, instead of saying, no, it can't be that because I know how this deal works, we should be people saying, well, wait, maybe I need to look a little closer into this. So this, putting this back in this context of Joshua and Moses, that you know, Moses got criticized himself for making some mistakes in leadership. I think that this Joshua, this was a mistake. He had tried to hold back on what God was doing. He was trying to protect Moses' name more than be interested in what God was up to. He was restrictive instead of releasing and all that stuff. But yet, it didn't actually stop him. While Moses, in leadership, you know, strikes a rock one last time, or he does something, and all of a sudden he loses the whole deal. So there's a seriousness to this anointing, this sense of leadership. There's also a sense in which mentoring, in which preparing the next generation involves letting them fail. And you kind of compare that maybe to Paul with and Barnabas with John Mark, who blew it on something and got scared and left, and Paul's immediate thing was forget it. Over, he lost his potential in ministry. While there was Barnabas alongside and said, no, there, I think there's still a future here. I think there's an interesting element to that too, that Joshua was growing, was being moved in ministry, was moved in battle, was spiritual, everything, but he was still tripping up along the way. But mentoring involves believing in them. And again, in light of maybe the age of most of what are the things that God might have entrusted you guys to, show you generations ago, certainly decades ago, for Orange County, for Grace Fellowship Church, for your own families? What are those things that maybe haven't quite come true yet, but you could say, look back and say, like Moses, because you, for whatever reason, you said, I'm not going to enter it, but someone else will. What are the dreams that we have actually God is going to do through somebody else, your sister, Joshua, son of Nun, whatever. What do you do? Encourage him, because he will lead Israel. I will give them the land and take possession of it. Again, in Deuteronomy 3, you've seen with your own eyes all that the Lord your God has done with these two kings. So Moses is having a vision. Joshua needs to learn, needs to grow. I'm going to take him through his experiences. He's seen it with his own eyes. And at some point, Moses was sort of taking it back a little bit. He's saying, I know I did that thing wrong. I know there's that, but we're getting close, and I really love to see this ministry give birth. I'd love to be part of it. Look, it's just right there. It's just on the good land beyond the Jordan. I find him over there. Come on, let me go over and see the good land. But, sorry, don't speak to me about that matter anymore. I know there's things you'd still like to see happen, but you can look at it with your eyes, you can get a taste, those dreams you have may be true, but somebody else is going to do it. And what that other person is this person, and what do I want you to do? Look at it, see it, and then go to Joshua, encourage and strengthen him. Across that, inherit the land that you'll see. There are a lot of people who need to be mentored, need to be encouraged and strengthened, to take up the mantle of what God would have for them. It might be different than what we expected, but there's some sense that certain dreams and destinies we've had going to come out through other people. And yet, this is just kind of, I said that earlier, Exodus 17, there's a story of them working together. Where Joshua is out leading the battle, the troops, against the Amalekites. Moses gave him the orders, and it's okay, you're going to go lead the fight. Joshua gets out there and does the fight, but he can't do the fight if he doesn't have Moses up there with his hands raised high. Moses is still giving the direction, giving it, you know, has some idea of how the battle needs to be done, but his role is an intercessory role. His role is praying. His role is something strategic. It doesn't work without Joshua doing the fighting, and it doesn't work without Moses backing it up. But when they they work together, the Amalekites get defeated. And each part's doing their part. Two roles, same goal. What does that look like in terms of leadership development in general? What does that look like for generations within our congregation? You know, there's a bunch of young, crazy bucks in our church. What are they dreaming of, and what can we be a part of helping them get there? That's the last slide, guys. Maybe you could pray for us quick, Al. Would you mind doing that? I'm sort of laughing. I have this in my AL. I used to be an AL, and that's the abbreviation for Albania. Then AL is apartment life in my new ministry. So we'll have AL pray for them all with a quick prayer here.
Lord,
guys.
Yes, sir. Yes.